Dear Adjunct, did the lady in Auschwitz, whose twin sister was killed, describe the process she went through to be able to forgive the perpetrator? Can you recommend some practices that can help us to forgive those who have hurt, harmed us, especially if we have to deal with them daily or regularly and they continue to repeat the same problematic behavior? Thank you. Now, there's a few cases you collect in life about amazing forgiveness stories, and of course that was one of them. And it's what it does, how she does that, and it takes a lot of reflection. The anger was just making her, she used to say, the anger was making her a victim every day, every time she thought of that or encountered that. It really hurt her. And after a while, it's like you feel that, why do I allow these people to continue hurting me? And, you know, you do have a choice. And that's the amazing thing which she discovered. She had a choice not to hate or, you know, to be, to let go, to be able to forgive, that she could do it. And that was a surprising thing. Once she realized she could, she had to not just hide it away, but to do something. And that was amazing that she could actually invite this guy over to Auschwitz and do the forgiveness ceremony there, where she forgave this man. And it was so many years ago. And as I also say that, you know, why do we have to hold the past, even the terrible things we've done in the past, to actually to defeat our present and our future? It makes no sense when you look at it that way. And then she managed to forgive him. And then when she did forgive him face to face, you know, in the place where all these terrible things happened, that made her the victor, not the victim. And it proved to me another of these amazing cases where anything can be forgiven. And when that happens, it's really inspiring. You know, it's almost like sacred or holy when somebody can do such forgiveness, even though it's hurt so much. It appears so rare. And the thing is that she realized, why do I want... I never did anything wrong. Why should I allow this event in the past to keep sort of hurting me, even though it was maybe 40, 50 years ago? And the other amazing sense of healing, or case of healing, which I often quote, was in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was done in South Africa. They managed to have a law which was the opposite of revenge. It was to say, if you can say in a court exactly what you did, you know, be really honest, even if it was extrajudicial killings and torture and terrible stuff you did, if you confess it honestly, then there'll be amnesty. And the idea was that once the truth can be, you know, spoken and people can find out what actually happened, there we can understand why on earth do we do such things. We can find solutions once there's honesty. And then, so on one of these episodes, there was a white South African police officer who was in the court, and he was standing up and just explaining how he'd tortured and murdered one of these black African ANC activists. And I remember reading some of the testimony, and it was really gross. And it just made me shiver. And one of the things they would do, please excuse me, and it's gross, you know, they used to take out this man's male organ and just bang a nail through it onto the desk, you know, to show they were serious. I mean, it's a gross thing to do. And anyway, he was describing, apparently, that while he was confessing what he did, it was obviously really difficult for anyone to actually to say that, you know, publicly. He was shaking, crying, and it was just emotional turmoil for him. And then when he'd finished his testimony, of how he was responsible for torturing and killing this Black African National Congress member. The whole family were there listening, especially his widow, his wife. And the wife, she said that all she remembered was in the middle of the night, her husband was, the police officers came in and arrested her husband, and she didn't know where he went or what happened to him. And this was the first time she found out, that he was murdered. You can actually call it murder, even though it's by the policeman, extrajudicial. And that the first time she knew what had happened. And you can kind of imagine how that must feel. I mean, not really imagine, but you can see just the trauma of that. And then when her testimony was finished, she jumped over the barrier. She evaded security guards and she went for him. He ran right to him. And they had a security guard there in the barrier between the person confessing the offence and the family who may be listening. She evaded all of those, went right up to him and gave him this enormous hug and said, "I forgive you." It was totally unexpected. And she meant it. Enough of the violence. Revenge just continues this cycle of violence and hurt and tears almost indefinitely. She decided to stop it. She hugged him, this white police officer, this black South African activist widow, just hugged. Apparently everybody just burst into tears. They couldn't help it. And I often quote that. If that can be forgiven, what else can't be forgiven? Basically, you can forgive anything. And it's really inspiring when somebody does that. And it gives hope for the world. No more wars. No more wars in the family, in the community. So anyway, how she did that, you have to ask her. The fact it could be done is step number one. To know that you can forgive, and it's totally beneficial on both sides. To know that you can be free of that pain from the past. You don't need to punish others, you don't need to punish yourself. And that's inspiring for me. All the pain which people have in the past, the trauma they have, can't we sort of lessen it by forgiveness? Never have any. People think, they'll do the same again. They don't. When you confess it in public like that, people just feel embarrassed, ashamed. When you hide it, that's when it can fester and grow and create more bad actions in the future. So that's one of the beautiful things to do, to know it can be forgiven. You can let go of it. "Dear Ajahn, sometimes when my mind is wandering, I bring my attention to my breath and body simultaneously. Is this a good path?" Yes, good enough. "Or should I try to stay only with the breath?" No, just whatever works, basically. So experiment. Try new things. Trial and error and see which works for you. It is a challenge. It is challenging as a layperson out in the world beyond Jhana Grove. There is much suffering, much pain, and much unkindness. I meditate daily. I follow the 5 precepts. I like to follow 8 precepts. My work is based on Buddhist principles. As a layperson who wants to and actively works on cultivating compassion, there is no Sangha near me. There are no monks or bhikkhunis to share their wisdom with me. WA YouTube podcasts are great, and I find asking about my meditation helpful. I am feeling guidance about my personal practice from someone who is in the Sangha, maybe monthly. Is this a kind of support that is available to lay people, or can we only find encouragement or support once a year in 10 minutes here? 10 minutes is the time for your interviews. Once, you know, the interviews are good, but the interviews, sometimes I answer the same question about 5 or 6 times in the afternoon. In other words, you get the same people and they ask the same, the different people, they ask the same questions. So that's why these Q&A time is much more helpful, because, you know, the same question and it's answered to everybody. It's even just, I think it's live streamed, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's live streamed, so many people get these answers. So that's a wonderful thing to be able to do. You know, the question time, the personal time in the interviews, and please use those frugally and save the best questions so they can be shared with everybody. I found that much more useful. And even these questions, you know, sometimes what happens that I read out one question and we don't choose what questions, we pick up the next question and it's almost identical. Two people ask the same question. It's not sort of coincidence, it's just sometimes the same little problem happens at the same time, the same people. Anyway, thank you for your wonderful... Yeah, so what's it actually to do? See how many times you can, you know, come over here or listen online. And obviously, I'm just one monk, you can't be everywhere. It's very challenging. You do get extra tired. You know, I am old now, and just all the challenging and all the flying and all the retreats. I'm always teaching a retreat somewhere, and you don't get much rest. And because of that, much of my energy I want to focus on training monks and nuns to do this job. There are some excellent teachers over there, 4 great teachers. You just want to encourage them to be more confident and just to go off and give a retreat in other countries. Not just here. Why not? Sri Lanka, you can be the head nun in Sri Lanka. The head nun in Malaysia, the head nun goes with Aichanda again, head nun in Thailand. Good idea. Yeah. Okay. But not yet. You've got to make sure that before you send monks and nuns overseas, we have such a thing, and I follow this, called quality control. So when they get a good QC stamp, they know what they're doing, then fine, you send them out. That's why I call Dharmasara, I don't call it Dharmasara Nuns Monastery. I call it Dharmasara Nuns Factory. And Bodhinyana is Bodhinyana Monks Factory. You get some of the raw material in, you churn it around, they go down the conveyor belts, and after a while when they come out the other end, I check them out, do they need to go back to the conveyor belt again and go through the process again? Well, QC, okay. Now you can go out and teach somewhere else. But it's not just, you know, being teachers. Not all monks, not all nuns will become teachers. Some of them will just become quiet, silent, enlightened ones. You can't have everybody teaching. It's just sometimes it's not in their character. But nevertheless, those who can do it, they should do it. And I know some people think, oh, it's just a hindrance to your meditation practice. Sometimes it is. But if you know how to use the energy which you gain from service, you never lose. And it inspires you, and your meditation practice takes off. You can get the best out of both. Okay, thank you for your wonderful sermon. Can you please explain the meaning of attachment and how to be free from it? Something which I noticed when I became a monk many years ago. And now I was just an ordinary young man. So when I gave up, sex, when I gave up relationships, I let go of that attachment. But then I picked up another attachment. Even though the food in Northeast Thailand was terrible, you still got attached to the food. And then so you gave that up and you found another attachment. You ever notice when you give up one thing, you find something else to attach to? It's like, I was attached to attaching. And so what I figured out, look at my hand, I'm always picking up something. I know that's what a hand is there for. That's its function, to pick up things. So how can I stop my hand picking up things? Cut off the hand. Okay, that's a bit gross. It's a bit sort of extreme. But I realise that's the only way you can actually stop picking up things. And that attachment, my mind was doing the attachment. What exactly was doing the attachment? So instead of looking at that end of attachment, what I was attaching to, I started focusing on what was doing the attaching, on this end of attachment. And when I looked at this end of attachment, you can see all these qualities, were emotional qualities, the lack of kindness. So I need to attach to something to make me feel good. Now the fear, well, if I don't have anything, I'm going to go crazy. What other people think of me. All those sorts of stuff. I studied the causes of attachment this side. It wasn't the particular things I was letting go of. It was what was actually doing those picking up things. And I thought that was a really sort of neat insight because no one had taught me that. Not even Ajahn Chah had taught me that. And then one day when I was looking through the suttas, I came across the Buddha's simile of the hand and the feet. That was one of those goosebump moments. You never read that before. You found out the Buddha got there before me, of course. And a similar simile. So don't be concerned about what you're attached to, but what's actually doing the attaching? That was actually part of the sense of like having a doer, having a sense of self. As long as there's a sense of an Ajahn Brahm in me, of course I'll always be doing something, attaching to something. That actually feeds the idea of an Ajahn Brahm. Sometimes I ask myself, who am I? A lot of time, you are what you do. I'm a monk because that's my job. Now, you may be a translator or you may be a business person. That's your job. You think that's who you are. You're a woman because that's what you, gender specification, but is that really who you are? And a lot of times when I keep asking these questions, who am I? When I can say, no, that's not really me. No, that's not really me. No, that's not really me. You feel so much more free. I am a wise monk, but sometimes I say some very silly things. Is that who I am? I do tell jokes. And over the years, sometimes I'm very good at telling jokes. So much so that when I was giving a talk in Melbourne many years ago, this guy came up to me after my talk and said, and I was really surprised, that you're, as a comedian, you've actually got a lot of good qualities. And he was actually working in the Melbourne Comedy Club. And he was on TV as well, this guy. And he said, your material was original. he didn't see monks do jokes before. It's original, your timing is perfect. And he said, honestly, I think I can get you a job in the Melbourne Comedy Club. He offered me work as a stand-up comedian. And I thought about it and said, no, I prefer my day job as a monk. But who actually are you? And this is one of the things, when you're attached to a particular role, then that's who you become. And that's the name which people know you by, professional comedian, or monk, or abbot. You know what they call the head nun? Abyss. No, they don't. That's why, can't we use the female form of abbot? You know, it's an abbess. But that's so close to the English word abyss that we don't use that anymore. So you just call it the female abbot, or whatever it is. What does the abbot mean anyway? The abbot is just supposed to be, abbe is just like a father in Latin. And I'm not anyone's father. I haven't given progeny. But nevertheless, that sort of idea of caring. That's the only word we have because, we don't, in Buddhist monasticism, and this, some people object to this, but it is true, the head monk is not, has not the authority. And you ask some monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery, what I say, what I want, do I get my way? No. It's the boss of a monastery is the community, the Sangha. That's the highest authority. The Sangha decides, not the head monk, not the head nun. I know they tried to change that. In Thailand, for example, the laws are there that the head monk, they don't actually recognize nuns yet, crazy, but the head monk, if Bodhinyana Monastery was in Thailand, and if one monk was just causing me trouble, I could actually tell the police, come and throw him out. And the police would do that. Any monk, if Ajahn Brahmani said that was a terrible joke, Ajahn Brahm, I say, right, that's it. Call the police and throw him out. It was just the hierarchy was more important. Anyway, so attachment, how to be free from it, really is that attachment. It's not that you're attached to something, that something attached to you. That beautiful cartoon you have on the notice board over there, one of the loony cartoons, the mobile phone and its owner, and the owner sort of says, no, it's my phone. And the phone says, no, you're not, you are mine, I am not yours. And that's so true to mobile phones. How many of you have a mobile phone? None of you. The mobile phone has you. That's why they used to call it a cell phone, which is much more accurate. And you're very proud of how many bars you have on your cell phone. That's how you're free from it. After a while, you realize it's not in your interest, not in anybody's interest, you don't own anything. And after a while, you can just, these things come, these things go, whatever happens. Does donation help with meditation practice? Yes, if you really want to get a jhana, there's still opportunity. They cost. No. It's not the donation, it's the kindness and the generosity. But actually, what is donation? It is letting go. It's letting go of, personal power, wealth, or whatever. That's why the donation boxes, I've been asking for this for years, but it shows you just how little power I have. Stop calling them donation boxes. They're letting go boxes. And remember, whenever you go past one of those letting go boxes, what Ajahn Chah used to teach me, whatever you do, if it's like meditating, if it's sweeping, building a monastery, giving a talk, if you're meditating, give it everything you've got. So when you pass a donation box, give it everything you've got. It never works. Anyway, what it does do is it's a way of letting go, which is good. Can your ancestors, no, I did that one before, help in meditation practice. What happens with lay people who have experienced a jhana? Can they still lead an ordinary life with a job and family or do they all have to become monastics because they do not fit anymore? I'm thinking the cases of the man in a retreat in Australian national dress, of the man who got a jhana meditating in his bedroom and got driven to hospital. Certainly you know the fate of these two people. They're not monks. But it does change their life. They become much more spiritual. Sometimes, when you get these deep meditations, you're in a relationship. You've got, both of those two men had wives. Sometimes they have a family. There was this one man, Vicky, Victoria, you know who he is, but I won't say. He was on this retreat over in Sri Lanka. He was getting really deep meditation. And the teacher over there, and he should never do this, it was totally wrong, was actually telling him, I think you're a stream winner now. And he was always telling his wife in Perth about what was happening. And when he told his wife that the monk had said he was a stream winner, his wife was just so inspired. That's a really sort of high attainment. And then a few days later, he said, it's gone even deeper now that, I'm now a once returner. And then his wife started to get worried. And she said, darling, come home now. If you become fully enlightened, you won't be able to go to work and we won't be able to pay off the mortgage on our house. Come home before you become enlightened. That's what she said. But anyhow, that if you just get even jhanas, you do see life in a different way, but you can still live in the world. This sutta, which I often quote, it was like a Buddha's previous, Siddhartha Gautama's previous life as a monk under Kassapa. And the reason he became a monk under Kassapa, because his best friend was Gatikara. It's a Gatikara sutta. And the Gatikara was a disciple of Kassapa the Buddha. It's the previous Buddha before Siddhartha Gautama Buddha. And that Gatikara, the only reason he never became a monk, he had jhanas, was because that he had two parents who were blind. And they relied on him. He was elderly. And so he had to stay as a layperson. Because if he ordained, he'll be actually abandoning his duties towards his parents. And so, his lifestyle was kind of amazing. Now, the only way he made a living was selling pots. He'd make the pots, but he'd get the clay. He would never dig the ground for clay in case he hurt like a worm or a beetle living in the ground. He'd wait for animals to actually dig up the clay, or notice when the farmers made the dikes for the paddy fields, he'd use some of that to make his pots. And he would never sell them. He would leave them on a bench outside his hut with a sign, anyone wants a pot, please take one. Anyone who wants to leave some rice and beans, please leave some. It was like total barter. But he didn't really say how much, and that's actually how he made his living. And he'd keep more than five precepts. He was just a really simple, kind, good person. And that's actually how, if you start getting jhanas, your level of simplicity goes really up. Just like I was saying, that man who remembered his past lives. And he had to keep the five precepts. He could not do it. The meaning of the five precepts becomes just so obvious. Why would I want to break any of these? And the simplicity of your life. You're not really interested in making lots of money. You're just enough to get by. Simple house, simple even apartment is enough. What do you want all the rooms for? One room is enough. Just like the monks and the nuns live. And he was like a non-returner. And that's how he lived. And as for his further progress, if you're a non-returner, when you pass away, You get reborn in the pure abodes, and you get enlightened there. So you don't really lose out. You know, you take a bit more time because you're looking after your duties, like your parents, or you maybe have a child or a wife. This is other guy, this Burmese guy, who was got really inspired and wanted to become a monk, but he couldn't because he had a wife and kids a long time ago in Burma. So he worked really, really hard, did extra work in other people's fields for them for a fee, saved up his money, lived so simple, and when he had enough to look after, and his kids had grown up so they could look after themselves, but he had enough money to look after his wife, he gave all that money to his wife, and then ordained as a monk. And then apparently this man, that about 6 months or 1 year after becoming a monk, he was fully enlightened. And then the monks couldn't believe just how fast that was. Just 1 year after becoming a monk, now you're fully enlightened. And then he said that all those years when he was saving up for his wife to make sure that she was safe after he ordained as a monk, all that time he was always practicing his meditation as much as he possibly could, and practicing renunciation in particular. And so he was so close when he ordained as a monk. And he just became an arahant really quickly, as an enlightened being. So that's what happens. If you get these jhanas, then what happens, that really just gives your spiritual life such a boost. You can still be in the world, but you're far less worldly. You probably won't be able to maintain a job as a CEO of a big company. But nevertheless, you will be able to have a beautiful, peaceful, simple life. Usually just, you know, join these Buddhist lay groups around the world. If there's not one in your town, you make one up, start one. And then just devote your life more to Dhamma. Still do some work to make enough money to put food on your table. But that's about it. You know, life is actually... I said I didn't know much about money, but I know some things like food and just living simply. It doesn't take much, you know, to live a simple life. But, you know, we have big houses and big cars and just, you know, big machines to look at YouTube or to do emails. You can live much more simply, which means it doesn't cost that much. Nothing much you need to eat. It's amazing just how simple you can live. Anyway, I may be going over the top there because it's been a long time since I've been in the world. But I see people's houses in Australia, they're huge. Dear Ajahn Brahm, in your Bliss and Beyond book, explains during jhana we cannot hear any outside noises and will not have any thoughts. Yes, can you please explain how one feels in first jhana? Blissful, free from thoughts, free from the five senses. Of course that's blissful, it's like freedom. A lot of times what people think is enjoyable, if you know what deep meditation is, you know, it feels like an impingement, like being disturbed. All the noise, the sounds, disturbing you. So that disturbance is not there in the deep meditations. It's like you're free. Dear Ajahn, a Tibetan lady who has attained enlightenment wrote in her book that keep eyes open and half closed during meditation, because it's very hard to enter deep meditation with eyes closed. However, some teachers suggest eyes closed to avoid distractions. Can you shed some light on this? Thanks a million. It's obviously you keep your eyes closed. If you don't actually close them, they just turn off anyway. Nice experience, nice story. As a young man, still not ordained, in UK, I would go to any Buddhist place to do some meditation. I didn't really care about the teaching so much. I cared more about the practice of the meditation. So not quite then, about 1 year before I became a monk, I was, okay, I'll tell you what I was up to. I did 1 year teacher training course over in Durham University. And the only reason I chose Durham University, because my girlfriend was up there, that was all. And you know, I hadn't sort of totally committed to monastic life yet. So anyway, I went on this retreat. It was a Zen retreat, this monastery, Throstle Hole. And that was where, you know, you actually meditated in this barn with a whitewashed wall, and you had to keep your eyes open. That was the way they meditated, sitting there just watching this really boring whitewashed wall with your eyes open. And every now and again, the head monk would come down the line behind your back with a big stick, and if you were nodding, you got whacked with a stick. I never got whacked. You know why? Because the layman sitting next to me got whacked, and that kept me awake for all the time. It was fear kept me awake. And anyway, the main part of that story, I was just sitting there with my eyes open. I usually meditated with my eyes closed. With my eyes fully open, watching this wall, at least I knew how to be in this moment, how to be silent, how to be mindful. And I was just watching this whitewashed wall, not knowing what I was supposed to be doing, but not thinking, being peaceful, being silent, aware. And then the wall vanished. It was there one moment, and it wasn't there anymore. It disappeared. Now, there's one thing about me that I'm never really into being afraid of things. I was always adventurous. And so when that sort of thing happens, you know, a wall disappears into space. It's nothing. And then I thought, wow, this is interesting. Many people would be really terrified. Ah, what are they doing to me? You know, have they given me some drugs or some potion or something? And then it's like the training of a scientist. This is weird. What's actually happening? And it didn't take me long to understand. How does sight work? When you're seeing something, all those signals go to the brain, and the brain sort of is always overworked. So if nothing is really happening there, you're just watching a whitewashed wall, not interesting, not dangerous, not going to give you some special experience, you're just watching it and it's just nothing happening, the brain turns off. And I thought, that's exactly what happens when I close my eyes. When I close my eyes, I'm seeing the inside of my eyelids. That's nothing really interesting, and the brain learns how to just turn it off. Just like computers these days. You got something on your computer screen, it's not interesting, it doesn't change. The most important thing, it doesn't change. And after all, your computer screen goes blank. It turns off. The brain and computers only are wired to notice things which change. Things which are stable, always there, you can't notice. And that was a fascinating insight, because then, there's so much other stuff in me which is always there, and it's never disappeared, so I don't really know what it is. Your will, as I said this morning. It's only when your will vanishes and stops, you can have some idea of what it really is. And that's what happens in second jhana. Just like the fish. How could a fish ever know what water is? Born in water, lived all its life in water, and doesn't know anything else but water. So water becomes invisible to the fish. Do you know what air is? You can do experiments on it in the lab or something, but we're born as air around, as always there. You do know, as I said, when you fall in the water and you can't breathe, but a lot of the time we don't really know what air is, because it's always here. When it vanishes, then you can find out what it is. When the five senses and your body, do you know what your body is? People think they do, assume they do. And then one day, the body vanishes. As that's happened to some of you already. I remember just teaching meditation in Singapore once, and this guy came up, "Ajahn Brahm, what are you doing?" "I was meditating, my hands disappeared." They were terrified. "What's wrong with your hands disappearing? It's wonderful when they disappear." And they have a good idea of understanding what they are and what they do. But when the whole body disappears, now that's really cool. You have an understanding, a way of understanding now what this body is, once it's not there. But the will, sense consciousnesses, and all that disappears. Wow, that is really cool. You're so much more free, so much more blissed out, feel so much more meaning. And it shows, you know, we chant sometimes, you know, sight is suffering, hearing is suffering, sort of smell, taste, touch is suffering, mind, knowing, mind consciousness is suffering. Many of you may have read that, but you don't understand it and reject it. It's too challenging. Will is suffering. Sankhara, dukkhang. That's why many people don't like translating sankhara as will. But that's how the Buddha talked about it. To do is to suffer. How about not doing? That's lazy. I get into trouble if I don't do anything. That's the myth. You get enlightened, that's what happens. So anyway, keep your eyes open. I keep them closed. It's less distraction. A Tibetan lady who has attained enlightenment. Who the heck was that? Tibetan people don't attain enlightenment. They want to get reborn as bodhisattvas. You can't have both. Anyway, I don't know who it is. Why do people give up? Oh, because they're wise. Because at last they follow instructions. Whatever worldly goals or spiritual goals, why is it so hard to stick with goals? The goals, they just, if you score one goal, you've got to go and score another. The goals are endless. What do you want to achieve in life? If you achieve it, are you going to be happy? I remember doing this when I was... parents don't like me telling this to their kids. Though even when I was at university. Yeah, so, okay, so what? I passed my bachelor's degree in theoretical physics. Then what? Then you have to do a master's. Okay, yeah, I'll do a master's. Then what do I do? Then you do a PhD. Then after a PhD, when what do? Then you do another degree. People have got so many degrees and so little wisdom. And sometimes, then you have to go and what do you do next? Then you sort of go and get a car. Well, I remember we would try and get a car. Get an old car first of all, that's all you could afford. And then later on you work harder in life, then you get a bigger car, and then a bigger car, and then a sports car, and then you get a place to live. Start off with a small place to live, that's good enough. Then you've got a big place to live. And then you sort of get married, and you need a bigger place to live. Then you have kids and a really big place to live. And then you can't wait till your kids leave home, because then I'll be happy once my kids leave home. And then by that time you're getting old. And so that you start to make sure you've got enough insurance for your health cover when you get old. And then once you get old, then what do? A lot of times when people get old, that's when they start coming to Buddhist temples, because they think if they give enough money to the temples or to the churches or the mosques, then when they die, then they'll be happy. That's not everybody's life, but it's a lot of people's lives. That's why you see in most churches or Buddhist centres, it's mostly old people. Anyway, that's why the only time you can rest in peace in this world is in the cemetery. Why can't... Why can't we rest in peace now? That's why a lot of people, they think, okay, they can be peaceful when they're dead. How many people are peaceful when they're alive? They can actually rest in peace. They just go back to their hut, lay down, or maybe to your cottage and say, have a good night's sleep. You're not trying to get enlightened, you're not trying to improve your meditation, just let go and relax. Can you do that? Or when you go to your cottage after this talk, will you think, oh no, I've got to meditate, there's only a few days left, I've got to get something. And it's the same, isn't it, with even meditation. Okay, you get a jhana, there's a second jhana, you've got to get a second jhana. And it was so hard to get a first jhana, and that's not enough. And then Ajahn Brahm comes and I say, there's four jhanas, you know. Oh, God. And then you really work hard and you don't sleep. And then, no, tomorrow, Thursday. Tomorrow's Thursday, isn't it? Tomorrow you get the fourth jhana. And I say, there's now the immaterial states. There's no end to it. So anyhow, welcome to life and goals. Dear Ajahn, assuming we don't get into jhana in this lifetime, of course you will. Can you guide us what to do when we die? I remember you mentioned we all will see Nibbata. What should we do? Can we choose our next life? Choose no life. It was much better. So when you do die, of course, you know that you have to let go of your five senses and your body. You can't keep them anymore. So that's when this Nibbata, this light, appears. And now because of all these teachings you're hearing now, you think, oh yeah, no, I won't remember them by the time I die. You do. Just as I said about that story of Ajahn Chah and the mangoes, and all you can do to get a mango is sit down perfectly still and hold your hand out, and one will fall. Those stories, no, I forgot those. I just rejected them. I couldn't understand how I could remember that years later, and how beautiful that simile was. And that's when you die, you know, seeing that nimitta, you know exactly what to do. You just don't grab it. You don't make that your goal and just, well, I'm going for this. You're so peaceful. It's like that light at the end of your life comes to you. It's like the donkey and the durian. The donkey doesn't chase the durian, the donkey stops. The durian comes right into the donkey's mouth. All this amazing all this amazing stuff happens. Because, you know, you've learnt how to let go, how to relax, how to make peace, be kind, be gentle, how to just have mindfulness and kindness when you die. That's all. How to make peace and let go. That's very passive, but very powerful. And there's a good chance that you'd merge into one of those nimittas. And when you come out, you just start to let go properly and don't get reborn. Or, if you do get reborn, at least you get so much wisdom from there and become a stream winner at the end of your life. Or, even enter one of those jhana realms. The jhana realms, blissed out for eons. I'm not talking about 5-hour meditation. I'm talking about 5 eons, 20 eons. Really long time. And then some monks say, oh, but you're wasting time, you're just blissed out. And when you come back and get reborn anywhere, unlikely. You come and get reborn somewhere and you're just probably in some incredible, brilliant place with so much energy and power. And of course, you'll get enlightened very quickly. Anyway. Dear Ajahn, you speak of often regarding full enlightenment. Does that mean you can have partial enlightenment? No, if you're enlightened, you're always impartial. That's only a word joke. No, there's like four stages of enlightenment. You say full enlightenment just to say this is not just being a stream winner, but being total arahat. In other words, it's got no wanting left in you. And which one are you? There is no Ajahn Brahm. If there was, then I could answer that question. Ajahn Brahm. Oh, there's this one Sri Lankan monk years ago. I remember I was just looking after him for a while. That was Ananda Mangala. Did you ever meet Ananda Mangala? He was a Sri Lankan monk, but lived most of his life actually over in Malaysia, you know, in Brickfields Temple. He's one of these. Can I tell a few silly stories about him? Because he was in Brickfields Temple with who became the chief priest, Venerable Kesari Dharmananda, Venerable Narada was there, Venerable Piyadasi was there. These are some amazing group of Sri Lankan monks who did so much amazing things in the world. And anyway, they're having a cup of tea and discussing Dhamma. And then these two evangelical Christians came in. And they came in then because if you can convert these people, I mean, that's like a gold ticket up to heaven. That's what they thought. And so they said, no, we're on a mission from Jesus. We've been told to come here by the Lord to tell you just you're on the wrong path. And then this Ananda Mangala, he just didn't waste any time. He said, get out of here, you two bloody fools. You're not really supposed to say that. But he did. And those two people went. And the other monks, these really good monks, they were laughing their heads off and said, thank you, but you shouldn't say that. And he would, Ananda Mangala, you know, somebody asked him that question, are you enlightened? He said, I'm not enlightened, but I'm highly illuminated. Not highly illuminated, highly eliminated. And I thought that was quite a cool answer. Oh, okay, you want one of these stories. Can you please tell us the story of the weatherman and the monk? I think many of you may remember that. Maybe you haven't heard it. But anyway, there was in this monastery in the foothills of the Himalayas, the wise old abbot got sick and he passed away. So they elected a new abbot. And the new abbot, he was still young, but he was very wise and a very good leader. And then it came close to the autumn time. And the monks would always ask the abbot, good meditation, is it going to be a cold winter or a mild winter? We need to know. Because in that monastery, they had to collect, wood, from the forests to build the fires to heat the monastery. Because in the foothills of those Himalaya mountains, if it got too cold, they would die. And so the old abbot was always very wise and could always predict, whether it's going to be a cold winter, extremely cold, or just a mild winter. So the new monk said, just leave it with me. And I'll tell you tomorrow. So that night, the new head monk knew his meditation wasn't up to scratch yet. So instead of meditating to find out the answer, he got the number of the meteorological office in Delhi and rang. And he got through to the professor of meteorology there. He didn't say it was this new monk, this new abbot who was ringing. It was just an anonymous call. And he said, in the Himalaya regions, what is the forecast for this year's winter? And the professor said, we don't really know yet, but it's probably going to be a cold winter. And the head monk said, oh, thank you. And the following morning, he told the monks, he said, according to my understanding, It's going to be a cold winter, so we better collect some firewood. So all the monks were working extra hours, collecting firewood for the region and storing up in the monastery. And of course, after 5 or 6 days, they asked, is there enough firewood? He said, leave it with me, I'll find out tonight. So when all the other monks had gone to bed, he got out the mobile phone again and he called the meteorological office, got through to the professor and said, how's it going, the weather in this region of the Himalayas? And the professor said, actually, it's got much worse. We think it's going to be quite a cold winter. Thank you. And the following morning, the head monk said, actually, just the amazing information which I got last night, it's going to be a very cold winter. And so you have to go and collect more wood. So the monks went out for another 5 or 6 days, working their butts off, collecting wood from all over. And of course, they got the easy wood first of all. Now it's much further. They worked really hard for another week. And then they stacking the wood all over the place in the monastery. Is it enough? Leave it with me, said the head monk. That night, in the late at night, you know, when all the monks were asleep, anonymously called out this professor, how's it going? And the professor said, look, it's got much worse. This is going to be one of the coldest winters in the Himalayas. And so, you know, he was about to put down the phone. And he wanted to say, he said, well, how do you know it's going to be a cold winter? A very cold winter. And the professor said, I've been looking at the signs. All these monks in the holy monastery are collecting wood like nobody's business. It must be a cold winter. And the one who told me that story said, that's how the stock market works. Okay, I don't know anything about the stock market, but anyway, that was a nice little story. Do you want me? No, I guess you'd answer some questions instead of doing these stories. Dear Ajahn, okay, so habits are the result of past choices and they appear when the conditions are right. When habits do manifest, if one refrains from acting them out, they fade away and no seeds of future habit manifestations of that kind are planted. Instead of a habit of refraining, seed is planted, hence gradually the underlying tendencies are abandoned. Yeah, but it's not just saying no to things, because sometimes you find you can't say no. The habits are strong and they influence your choice. You are not as in control as you think you are. That's why one of the ways of overcoming those habits, the negative habits, are being with other people who don't manifest those bad habits. And you get conditioned by them. You can't do this by yourself. That's why we have retreats with many people coming together, why we have Buddhist societies, we have communities. And if you're in a very good community, when everybody else is in restraint, keeping precepts, it makes it very easy for you to keep those precepts. Many of you have been in Bodhinyana Monastery Main Hall, and it's really peaceful there. Many of you get deeper meditation there than other places. Why? Yeah, you may find courses, Buddha relics. Those are old pieces of bone. What else is happening there? Is there other places where people are meditating, where other people are getting peaceful? And that helps you get peaceful. We actually, Asewana Chabala Nang Pandita Nang Chasewana, the first verse of the Mangala Sutta. Associating with wise people, with good people, is a great blessing. Associating with fools is not. And it actually works. many times here in Perth, people send their wives to Dhammasara for a retreat. And they come back just new, improved versions of the old. We're like, that same as send your husband to Bodhinyana. And they get kind of tuned up. Their kindness increases, their wisdom increases, they rest, and they've got a much more positive attitude to life. Because they feed off the good energy of the monks and nuns. We're happy to do that. So you can't just decide, I'm going to stop these bad habits. You need some external influence as well. Anyway, next question. Isn't samadhi is to attain one-pointedness of the mind and that insight can be gained and liberation achieved? Yeah, I don't see what's that, but it's not one-pointedness of the mind. That's a bad translation of ekagata. Ekagata doesn't mean one point, and agga is a peak of the mind. That's Pali is agga. The Sanskrit version of agga is agra. And you know that city in India which bears the name of Agra, where they have the Taj Mahal and the Red Fort? That was the capital of the Mughal Empire in India. Agra means a peak, not just an ordinary point, but a summit. And that's actually what the jhanas are. It's not ekagata. In Sanskrit, it would be ekagrata, the one peak of the mind. Not just an ordinary point, but a peak, a summit. And that's when you understand what jhanas are, you understand these are peaks of mind. Even to the point that the fourth jhana is the peak of mindfulness, the purity of mindfulness. You can't get more mindful than the fourth jhana. Do you understand? Maybe. Anyway, dear Ajahn, kudos to the team, Nicola, Christine, Pat and Scotty, for keeping the retreat running smoothly and beautiful. Much gratitude. Kudos so far. Another couple of days ago. No, they're doing a great job. If our will is always conditioned, how does that square with the right effort to put in the courses for good meditation and the path more generally? Wouldn't the propensity to follow the path also be preconditioned? Right effort, if you look at it, is, and really look at it more deeply, the term effort does not belong to the explanation which follows afterwards. It's basically whatever gets rid of unwholesome qualities in the mind. I don't know how many of you already in the interviews have been saying you've got this problem, and I say, don't try and get rid of it. Acknowledge it. Be kind to it. The anger-eating monster. How do you get rid of the anger-eating monster? With right effort? Get out of here, monster. If your effort is not enough and the monster is bigger than you, got more effort, you get more soldiers in. Come and get out. Not through effort, but through wisdom. There's this beautiful story. It's repeated again and again in the Buddhist texts. But it starts off with the Bodhisattva, Siddhartha Gautama, not enlightened yet, sitting under the Bodhi tree. And Mara comes up with his army to try and tell the Buddha, you don't deserve to sit here, get out. And the Buddha was just one single human being. Get out, you don't belong. How did the Buddha deal with that? I know you, Mara. Not fighting back, with kindness and wisdom. Then he tried to tempt the Buddha with his three floozies. I think that's the right word for them at the time. Dancing and trying to arouse the Buddha. And the Buddha, same as them. Look, you know, I know who you are. didn't sort of fight them or tell them off. And all the time, ever since, when Mara would ever try and come and disturb anyone meditating close to enlightenment, the monk or nun would just say, "I know who you are, Mara." And Mara would actually just shrink away, head down, shoulders hunched. "The nun knows me, the nun knows me." Mara was always beaten by wisdom, not by brute force, not by effort, but by wisdom and kindness. I love those stories. I said this to one of the meditators today in the interview. It's like you have a barrier, a problem in your meditation. Like, you know, you're right in front of a huge brick wall. You know what some people try and do? Break down that wall, bang their head against the wall, hammer that wall. They use effort and they just get a sore head or a sore hand. All they need to do is stand back a little bit and they find, oh, just to the left there's an open door. That's called wisdom. They don't need to harm themselves. Wisdom and kindness, that is what gets you through. It's an important point, that's why I emphasize it. Samawayama, usually translated as right effort, but you see it's more like right restraint. It's what you don't do, not what you do do. Next question. Who are the devas that can help us? Which realms are they from? How do we ask for their help? Here is their email address. You see that? I didn't see this. Next sentence. Do they have an email address? Or do they prefer a chart? If so, which one? Thank you. You know, sometimes the heavenly beings who help you, they could be like relatives of yours. Sometimes. Just keep an eye on you, just in case you, because they still have that connection with you. But the more powerful devas, they would only assist if there's something really, 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 really important. You know, just like a 30th anniversary of, you know, of Buddhist society. I know, like, good monks or good nuns need some help. Or you need some land for Dhammasara. And he just comes. And sometimes it's crazy. And first of all, being a scientist, you don't believe that. But then you try it out because you're desperate, and it works. How do we ask for their help? If you really have something important, I mean, not your own health, or, you know, your own sort of business, but something which is for a bigger purpose, a bigger cause. And then you just ask, may the heavenly beings help. This is important for the safety and well-being of so many beings. Then there's a good chance, and especially if you are a good practitioner. Why do some of the nicest kind of people suffer a lot? Why do some of the nicest kind people don't suffer? Am I kind? Am I nice? Do I look like I'm suffering? One of my friend's wives cheated on him and also took most of his money away. Is it past life karma? It's a wonderful opportunity for your best friend. Because, you know, it shows him that you can't control life. You do think that you met a nice person to share your life together. But sometimes, even though you go out with them and you live them with for a short time, do you really know them? How hard is it to know yourself? Let alone know someone you live with. It's very so dangerous because we always protect some of the parts of us we don't want to show others. How honest are you with yourself? I think I already did I think I did tell that story of, you know, my confession of, you know, when I think I did already, about many, many years ago, I spent some of the happiest hours of my life in the loving arms of another man's wife. Did I tell that story already?
No.
Okay. That was my mum. She's my dad's wife, not my wife. We kissed, we hugged, we loved each other. I can't forget the first time I told that story. And the people actually did draw in breath. Not Ajahn Brahm as well. Anyway, if so, he meditates, prays a lot, still he's suffering because of this. He's the most kind, compassionate person I've ever met. It means, see, he's not the wisest one you have ever met. If you were wise, you say, well, why do I suffer? It's not his fault. What has that man done wrong? Nothing. So you always look at, you know, what you have done. And if there's no fault on your part, there's no need to suffer. You've obviously married someone who was just, you didn't really understand, and you made a bad choice. So it means that you learned from that. And I also took most of his money away. Sometimes will money get you happiness? Money will get you food. But you learn so much from that. You don't get negative. He obviously had to learn how to live pretty simply after that. Not his fault. So he should never blame himself. One of the stories, I love telling this story, was of as Chao Khun Thep Sitimuni, his name was. And he was the abbot of what was it called? It was one of the big meditation monasteries in Bangkok, in the Sonam Luang. And he was highly regarded. He was a good scholar, a good meditator, a very kind person. And he was number three in line to be the Sangharaja of Thailand. And then he was number two in line to be the Sangharaja of Thailand, sorry. The current the Sangharaja of that time was, you know, getting old. And the number three in line for the Sangharaja was jealous. He wasn't such a good monk. And that number three realized he would never become the head monk of Thailand if this really good monk, Chao Khun Thep Sitimuni, was still there. So he had to find a way to get rid of this number two monk in Thailand. So what he did, he got some of the recorded talks which were on those old reel tapes of this monk, spliced them, added one here and one there, and could prove, you know, from that talk that this number two monk was a communist. And at that time, that was illegal in Thailand to be a communist. But, you know, sometimes we say, well, share things. I say that quite often. You know, just let go of things. You don't need to amass much. And sometimes if you listen to some of my talks, chopped a bit off here and added a bit there, you can probably prove that I was a communist. Or a follower of Donald Trump. I don't know what you could prove. But then this number three monk, you know, presented this to the authorities, and there was a trial of the number two monk, and he was convicted of being a communist. And if you're convicted, in a court of law in Thailand, you have to wear white clothes. You can't wear your brown robes. They say that's like an affront to the brown robes. So he was put in white robes and put in jail for 2 or 3 years. And then later on, the head monk of Thailand died, and then so the number three monk took over. He got his aspiration, became the head monk of Thailand. But then he was in a police escort in a nice big car being driven, I think, to Don Mueang Airport on the way back, I forget exactly which. and there was a freak accident, a car on the opposite side of the freeway, and they only had like a dual carriageway, they'd call it probably these days, lost control of the car, went over the median strip and slammed into the car carrying the Sangharaja. And he was the only one who was killed. And that was such a freak accident that many people in Thailand said this can't be a coincidence, there's something up here, why the head monk had been killed and no one else. And so they investigated and they found out this case where he'd accused Chakon Thep Siddhi Muni of being a communist, and they reinvestigated. It was obviously, it was just made up, a trumped up story. So they freed Chakon Thep Siddhi Muni, apologised to him for putting him in jail for a couple of years without really good cause. And I remember just reading the story of Chakon Thep Siddhi Muni and how he wasn't at all angry or upset. He said, "Oh no, thank you." When I was in prison, it was in a reasonably comfortable cell, probably as good as the room in which I live in, because I'm a monk, and I got really good food, and I never needed to give any interviews or talks or teach any retreats. I had the best 2-year personal retreat of my life. I could catch up on my correspondence, read all those old books I always wanted to read but never had the time, because being a senior monk, you got so much business and stuff to do. It was like a 2-year retreat. Who can complain about that? Thank you. And when I read that, I thought, wow, that's a real monk. So if you go in jail, you just enjoy it. You see the benefits of it. I sleep on the floor in my cave. If I go to jail, I get a proper bed. I wouldn't need to give any retreats. I can just sit there in my cell all day, just meditating, enjoying myself. Sounds quite attractive, doesn't it? Can you accuse me of something? No, anyway. Oh, my goodness. Where did the time go? I just have too much fun. That's the trouble. Okay. In the word of the Buddha, I remember hearing there is no permanent essence, soul, correct? What, then, is the stream of consciousness? The stream of consciousness is like the stream in a river. You stand on a bridge, you watch the stream today, and it looks exactly the same as the stream yesterday. That's why you give it a name, the Swan River, or the Thames River, or the River Nile, or whatever it is. But then you also know the water you see today is totally different from the water you see yesterday. It's not the same. It's not even one particle of water yesterday, which is there, which you see today. It appears the same, but the truth of the matter, what was there yesterday is gone. Same with this thing you call the stream of consciousness, or this thing which many people call soul. The thing which people think is a soul yesterday is totally different than the thing they think of a soul today. It's changed. It's mutated. It's gone. There's no permanent essence there. Okay. Isn't that like an energy that moves from one form to the next? Energy is, you know, it's like an essence of life. What is it called? That's right, like form energy. I've even got my physics terms now, like, you know, stuff, material and energy, they're interchangeable, and that's the thing of life. But it's always, there's something always there, in the stream of consciousness, there's nothing there. So where does it go when it dies? The Buddha gave this wonderful simile of the oil lamp. I just changed it slightly to a candle. And the flame of a candle, the candle flame is burning. What is the candle flame? The candle flame is the sum of three conditions: the wick, the oil, and the heat. They come together, you get the flame. And when the wick is all burnt out, when the wax is exhausted, or when a wind blows out the heat, Where does the flame go? Where is the essence of the flame reborn? It doesn't go anywhere. It ceases. And the word for ceasing was the past participle associated with the, the noun? I've got a special word for it in grammar. Nibbana. The word is nibbuto. Idampi nibbuto yatayang padipo. That's in the Ratana Sutta, which we chant. I did got the first word wrong, but anyway. That's how people in the time of the Buddha, even little kids, would say, "Mummy, the flame is nibbana." Nibbana was a word which everybody knew. It wasn't a metaphysical word invented by the Buddha. It was a word in common usage. It means that something like a flame, because of the causes, had stopped. The flame had ceased. That's what happens to you. You go out, you cease. Where do you go? You don't go anywhere. Where do flames go? You just cease. Do you understand? No, you don't. But anyway, that's enough for now. It's almost 9:15. Sorry about that. Oh, my goodness. I think there's more questions left over than yesterday. But never mind. There's actually many more than yesterday. I don't know, is this okay to ban questions? No more new questions?
We can always extend the retreat.
now I figure out what you're doing. I should just see. Only if you have a really important question, try not to put one in. If you do put one in, you can't put two in. And by not two in, I don't mean, okay, I'll only put one question in, 1A, 1B, 1C, 1D, 1E. For tomorrow, so we can get, look, there's so many of these left. Sorry. But you know, a lot of times I don't really personally mind just taking so much time for questions because it makes the talk more alive. You know, you ask me these questions rather than me telling you something. And some of the Dhamma which is talked about in these questions is, you know, far deeper than what we talk about during the formal talks. So these will be answered. But no, not this evening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay.